Tonight on Arena, Gran Turismo, Haunted Mansion, Facedown and La Mensita are the movies up for review, and Peter Murphy on Neil Jordan's new novel, The Well of Saint Nobody. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And we start this evening with film reviews. We'll have Fast Cars, Bellaroma and A Haunted Mansion that may or may not leave you tingling. Two of our films tonight are based on existing intellectual property, but both do give interesting twists to that. Gran Turismo is the unlikely true story about a player of the game, or should I say simulator, who and how he broke into the world of motor racing. And it features Jerry Halliwell. I don't think she's singing. We will find out. Facedown is a harrowing Irish feature documentary about the kidnapping of German businessman Thomas Niedermayer and the trauma visited on his family, which has lasted through the generations. Penelope Cruz leaves Madrid for Rome to star in La Mensita, a coming-of-age story set in the 1970s with suitably kitsch soundtrack to match, and Haunted Mansion. Disney is once again inspired by a theme park ride, promising jumps and scares along the way. Ruth Barton, Paul Whittington have been to the movies for us, and they're with me in studio this evening. And Paul, I'm starting with Gran Turismo, and I've used the word gaming now twice. And
yeah,
the film will be very angry with me. Gran Turismo is not a game.
No.
It's a driving simulation.
It's a driving simulator. Yeah, it's a driving sim, exactly. And that point is made an awful lot during the film. And the story behind it is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And might have made a good film. This character, Jan Mardenborough, who was 19 in 2011, when he entered this competition, which called the GT Academy, which the Gran Turismo company, Nissan and Sony, were running. And it gave gamers, as they didn't like to be called, the chance to become real drivers, real racing drivers.
And Gran Turismo, this gaming, which wasn't a game,
yeah,
which was a driving simulator, that's exactly what it was. You sat down and it was the equivalent.
Very realistic.
Yeah, like flight simulators, the way that pilots are trained. It's that type of thing.
It was
that realistic.
Exactly. And that realistic, that good, which meant that this young fella thought that he had got good enough to become a racing driver, and you know, he was in for a bit of a shock.
For sure. And helping him realise that shock is it David
Harbour.
Yes.
David Harbour, who's the kind of salty, kind of gruff,
old
driver who doesn't believe in any of this.
He's the only really good actor in the film.
From Stranger Things.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a classic sports movie. You have he's basically the coach of the young fella who's perhaps, you know, who dreams of being on the team, and that's really, you know, it could be any sport if you call, you know, whatever kind of racing this is a sport. I mean, oh my God, you know. I sat in the cinema and we watched this in the IMAX. And of course, the point is that we must feel that we're racing as well. So the whole thing is kind of driving at you. And somewhere, I mean, I totally agree with Paul. There's a really good story there. If they'd actually stopped the movie for like the stuff for 30 seconds and allowed people to actually develop their personalities, their characters, and maybe put in, I mean, he's a very young, very inexperienced actor.
This is the guy playing the character.
Mardenborough.
He's kind of sweet in the role, I think.
He needed, like, it's directed by Neil Blomkamp, who we all remember, you know, years ago from District 9.
Which was an amazing movie.
Amazing. And he was really hot after that. And, you know, here's where you end up when it's not working out for you, I think. And, I mean, I had a sense that here's somebody who got the actors together, gave them their lines, and then handed over to the special effects team. Because really, nobody's kind of very directed. You know, as you're saying, yeah, absolutely, David Harbour is good and he's experienced. We do have Jerry Halliwell. And I said to myself, what's Jerry Halliwell doing in this? But then I discovered what you may not know is that she is in fact married to Red Bull Formula One team principal Christian Horner. So I think there may be a family connection.
Impressive research there.
Well, that is. That's why I am a professor of film studies.
And I'm not.
Let us listen to, this is David Harbour, and you've both mentioned him as kind of the real strength of the movie.
Yeah, anything that works is because of him.
Yeah, and Jack Salter is the name of the character, and he's giving a rousing speech to a group of Gran Turismo players who are aspiring to be real race car drivers.
All these folks behind me are keen on y'all proving you can do the impossible. I'm here to prove that you can't. This is not a game. You're going to be forced to make split-second decisions that could cost you your life. These are incredible stakes. And if you're not willing to risk it, I want you to walk away. Because if you stay, I'm going to push you harder than you have ever been pushed. And I'm going to prove that you don't have what it takes. Welcome.
There you go.
Some team talk, right? Yeah,
some music in the background, too.
Did they have the music playing on set, and did he actually have to raise his voice to stay above it?
Well, actually, he actually is the
only... I should say that was David Harbour in the scene as Jack Salter, seen from Gran Turismo.
He is really the only actor in it who finds his managers, who's good enough to find his way through it and create a convincing character. Like Orlando Bloom starts at kind of panto level.
He's a marketing executive. Yeah. I mean, that says it all about
the movie. Very excitable.
Right?
And he just starts so high that the only way is kind of a slow descent and he's not very good. And I mean, Jerry Halliwell is Jerry Halliwell. There's, you know, she's in Cardiff, in suburban Cardiff, we're asked to believe
seen,
that.
First scene loading clothes into the family washing machine. Yeah. And that's probably the main thing she has to do in the movie.
Yeah, and she says if she looks surprised a few times. I think the whole point, as Ruth was suggesting, is that no dramatic flow is allowed to occur and that every character other than the main, than Harbour and the kid are really adjuncts to that story. And also, it's about maybe 30 minutes too long, to be generous. But some of the racing stuff is actually good. The climactic thing, there's a scene at the Le Mans 24 Hours. I thought that was well done.
But there's a film in there, so the effects are great. But what's the film that's in there that we're not getting? What did you want to get or see that you didn't
see? Well, I really want... I mean, it is this story about an outsider, and he wants... You know, his father in real life was a professional football player. And so he wants to emulate his father's success. And he's also, you know, he's a mixed race character, which, you know, he's an outsider.
There's lots that could have been said about
that. Yeah, and there's lots that could have been said about that. And he's an outsider. He's from Cardiff, which probably makes him an outsider. Not that he has a Welsh accent, but, and so I think that story of the outsider who manages through tech, you know, and there's something amazing about being able to actually, I mean, he ends up being able to, there's something amazing about being able to do it. There's all kinds of really interesting backstories there if they decided to explore them.
The main thing I learned from this film, Sean, is that champagne is for the podium. You can only if you win a race can you drink champagne.
So that's the money shot, right?
Okay, well, it's on the podium that you see all of that happening right enough. Yeah. But that's why they spray it down to the lowlies down below. Look, if you want to drink this.
Yeah.
That's a total diversion, let's be totally honest. Jerry Halliwell, just because she's one of the Spice Girls, is she given nothing to do or can she just do nothing?
None of the women are given anything to do because
there's a girlfriend,
can't even remember her name. No. She's there just to be kind of anxious and then nurturing. Yeah. And mum is there to be anxious and nurturing. Women are there to be... And I think one of the competitors to get into the race is a woman, in fact.
Yeah.
Like, she doesn't even get a... Like, we don't even...
Right. Now.
Don't remember her name even.
Sounds like you're both a little bit annoyed at Neil Blomkamp, who is the director.
Yeah, he needs to up his game a bit and just find a good movie to direct.
Stars.
Well, I gave it 2 because of what it might have been.
And what did you do, Paul?
Yeah, 2. I mean, as I said, some of the racing sequences are not dreadful.
There's one for the poster.
Damning with some praise.
Some of the racing sequences are not dreadful. All right. And what did you say stars wise?
2.
2. Yeah. So that's 2 2s is what we're getting there for the first of our films this evening, Gran Turismo. Totally different tone, totally different style of true story being told in face down. This is a feature documentary on the kidnap and murder of the German businessman Thomas Niedermayer and the tragic fallout for his family subsequently. Just remind us of it brings back such awful memories of a time in Northern Ireland and in Belfast in particular, this story, Ruth.
It's a shocker. It really is. And it's really worth people being reminded of this through this document. So really, very basically, in 1973, this German industrialist, Thomas Niedermayer, he'd been sent to set up the Grundig factory in Northern Ireland. This was part of the whole new sort of opening up of Northern Ireland. And one of the great things about the factory was that Protestant and Catholic worked aside and seemed to have been run on progressive lines. He seems to have been a very decent guy. He moves over with his wife, Ingeborg, and his 2 small daughters, Renate and Gabby. And there's some lovely sort of background, old family tapes of them adjusting to the Irish weather, going to swim and find the Irish Sea a bit chilly. They're the most ordinary family and they seem to have been well-liked by their employees. And then one night, December the 27th, 1973, just after Christmas, Ingeborg, the, book. The mother is in hospital. The doorbell rings and two men come in and say, "Oh, sorry, we ran into your car. Would you just come out and have a look at it?" And one of the girls actually opens the door to these men, and then Thomas Niedermeyer follows afterwards, whereupon they kidnap him, bundle him away, and he's never seen again.
Let's listen to a clip which is the immediate reaction in the news footage and from some of the employees, I presume, is who we're hearing speaking here. This is the immediate reaction to the kidnapping.
The police and the security forces are still keeping an open mind about the case. But as the hours pass and no word is received from the kidnappers, there is increasing concern as to exactly what has happened to Mr. Niedermeyer.
Mr. Niedermeyer had disappeared and nobody was saying what had happened. There was a great lull of mystery and worry.
We look on Grondegg as a model factory, as a place where Catholic and Protestants work together equally. And we want this man released.
But as time goes on, of course, it gets more and more distressing. And one cannot be absolutely certain at this time. But I sincerely hope that the man's still alive.
It just, that clip from Face Down, documentary film about the German businessman Thomas Niedermeyer, who's kidnapping and murdering. When you hear that news footage, Paul, it just pulls you right back to that awful, awfully dark time. And that one woman in the midst saying Grundig is a model factory.
Yeah.
Protestant Catholics work side by side here.
Yeah, it's incredibly sad. And there are lots of these stories, of course.
Yeah.
And this is one of the more shocking and pointless ones.
It was been kidnapped by the IRA.
Yeah, and it was the first sanctioned kidnapping. They hadn't done it before. Then ETA had done it quite successfully in Basque Country, so they decided to follow suit. And they needed a bargaining chip because of Marion Dolores Price, who were in London and they were on hunger strike and they wanted them to be moved to Belfast. And that was the background to it and the reason for its organisation. And also he was a soft target because he had no protection, whereas judges, etc., all did by that stage. The story is told really well in this, principally by the two granddaughters, one of the daughters, two daughters, and the dignity with which they describe the sort of generational
trauma,
chaos and misery that this caused is really impressive.
There's also lovely sequences where you get friends of the two daughters at the time, Renate and Gabriella.
Yeah.
There's one, this sequence even.
Yeah, it's very moving, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Even as the woman is trying to remember the scene, you can just hear the pain of remembering what went on at the time.
Mm.
Renate lived at the top of the hill and I remember going up to her house frequently. Mrs. Niedermeyer was so welcoming, and when you would go in, she'd be so hospitable. And she always made us tea and biscuits. Mr. Niedermeyer was a very tender, gentle father, very involved and interested in everything that Renate was doing. She had a big sister. We used to think she was fantastic because she had makeup and she had nice dresses and she wore nice clothes and she had a boyfriend.
Well, I first met Gabby when I was 13, when I went to boarding school. I was a boarder and she was a day girl. She was a very quiet girl. She wasn't one of the noisy, rowdy ones like some of my friends. And she had a lovely, calm dignity. Sorry. She was very dignified, almost like sort of Princess Grace in a way that she moved and dressed and very easy to be friends with.
Just beautiful the way they
got great interviewees in this. I mean, they have one of the key interviewees is June McClinton, who was Niedermeyer's personal secretary, herself a very glamorous woman. And she goes
some of
back.
The stuff that came out in the press was awful in the absence of any
this
information,
is it.
Wasn't
and
it?
And the speculation, because then there was, really? What was her real relationship to Niedermeyer? And this is, she was just a very loyal employee of the
and
company.
And you can hear from the description, I love the way they refer to the parents as Mr. and Mrs. Niedermeyer. Did bring
brings you back today, to the time, doesn't it?
Today, of course, they'd be referred to by their first names, by the pals, but not then. You wouldn't. You refer to your neighbour as Mr. and Mrs. You wouldn't. You wouldn't dare use the first names.
And they really respected them.
Yeah.
And it keeps coming through over and over again how respected these couple
was. Of course,
and
those who know the story will know about the intergenerational trauma that was visited upon the family. But that is what the film is about, essentially, Ruth, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it's a political film because this is about politics. But it's not really, it's not an expose. It does point to the person that they believed was behind the kidnapping, Brian Keenan. And they also suggested he'd worked actually in the Grundig factory and that he might have had a grudge against against Niedermeyer personally. So this might have been one of the motivating factors in kidnapping. But it's not really about the IRA or about the various other factions.
It's about the impact of violence. There was no truth, for complicated reasons, there was no truth and reconciliation process in the North the way there was in South Africa. So all these stories are coming out in bits and pieces, and the feeling in that family is very strongly that this one has been forgotten, and it's particularly egregious as well.
Yeah. Okay. Stars from you on this one, Paul?
Four.
And what are you saying?
I gave it 4.5. There were a couple of interviewees who were there to tell us what trauma was, who I thought were extraneous. Yeah. But I thought, this is actually
the real story.
This is a documentary that lives up to its 1.5 hour running time, which they don't always. I thought it was really good.
David Blake Knox and A Doc on One, a book by David Blake Knox.
That's also right, and there's a documentary on one as well.
So it seems as if it's a story that merited its transfer to the screen. Very high stars from both of you. Okay, let us move on. Well, we won't move on right now. We've two more films to go. We'll do them after this break. Okay, back to our film reviews now, and we're off to Italy. L'Immensità takes us, and Penelope Cruz, in fact, to the Rome of the 1970s, an atmospheric story of family conflict and gender dysphoria. Give us set the scene for us here, Ruth. We're in Rome, as I say, in the 1970s. Penelope Cruz, is she still Spanish?
She's married. She's married to an Italian, and one of the sort of sources of conflict in the film is she's a very spontaneous Spanish woman, and he is kind of family bound, rather repressed Italian man. So the marriage isn't in great shape, even as the movie starts, because as we are very soon going to find out, he's having it off the secretary, whom he's going to knock up in 70s terminology. And so things are only going to get worse between the two of them. Meanwhile, their eldest daughter, Andrea, is growing up transgender. And as you said, she has gender dysphoria, though that term, of course, isn't even...
I wouldn't be aware of that
nobody
term
would. Nobody's talking about it in that
yeah.
way. She's simply a girl who dresses up as a boy in terms of the film. And in fact, for his rather straight-laced family, this is not acceptable, and they try to get her to put on a frock. Whereas mum, Penelope Cruz, Clara, she's well in touch with her, let's say, her son. She also really can't control Adri. Yeah. So Adri is a sort of free spirit, but he's also, unhappy. He's sort of trying out identities. And he also believes, like every good teenager, that he is in fact an alien from outer space and is not biologically related to anybody in his immediate environment.
And so he should, as a teenager, believe such things. But it is interesting, Paul, I suppose, that the theme of gender dysphoria is very much something of the moment now, or certainly something that people are much more aware of.
Yeah.
The language around gender, all of that has been developed and changed fundamentally in recent times. And I know there are those who would say, possibly quite rightly, that there's still a lot of work to be done in that regard. But are we looking at this 1970s story with the eyes of 2023?
In some ways we are, yeah. And that's kind of a failing of the film, because there is absolutely no doubt that this has always happened, that gender
confusion. It's not a new phenomenon.
It's not a new phenomenon, but I think that the way in which Adri is handling it is, possibly it would have been very difficult to achieve at the time. There is a kind of quite touching relationship, although you wondered, he meets a girl at this transit camp and she's very sort of feminine, and they seem to be falling in love. You wonder whether she knows or doesn't know.
Yeah.
And if she doesn't know, it doesn't seem very fair. However, what's fair when you're 14 or whatever it is, or 13?
Yeah.
I think the strengths, Penelope Cruz is somewhat miscast. I love when she plays, these salty working class Madrilenas, as she has done so brilliantly for Almodóvar for many years. She's great at that. She's not convincing as somebody as passive as this for me, but What the film does well and ought to do more of is use these fantastic 1970s pop songs by, you know, people like Raffaella Carrà and people like that, and they're fantastic, and you want more of them actually,
yeah,
because
no,
they punctuate the misery a bit,
and that's
don't
the escape
they?
For both Adrian and Clara from this, you know, very straight-laced, you know, kind of dark furniture sort of housing, which is they both go off, and there's a fantastic scene where they run through the streets of Rome singing and you know, singing and kind of knocking
and
people
Cruz is
over.
Still good, even though I don't think she's
I think she's too strong actually for the movie. This is kind of quite a light sort of observational movie, and she's a big star, and she can't be anything else but a big star. So she's, to me, she kind of topples the movie over a bit by that huge performance.
Yeah, what about those around her? I mean, particularly, I suppose, the young Luana Giuliani, who's playing the part of Andrea Adri.
Yeah, Adri, I mean, I thought Luana, who is a young female actor, was actually beautiful and she had lovely eyes. And I thought she did her best to carry this movie, because, I mean, all the other characters are not even at the races in terms of characterization. It is purely a son-mother relationship. And I thought she was good, and
I thought the husband was absolutely odious,
hypocritical,
sexist.
Who
must have been exceptional even in Italy at the time. But I think he's quite good.
Apparently he always acts. He's Emanuele Chiesi's, who's the director.
Yeah.
He's his favourite actor.
He's always acting.
And this is an autobiographical story. The director himself is transgender. And so it is meant to be
his
story growing up in the 70s.
One thing, I suppose, the Spanish-Italian divide is interesting, in that you were saying that the Penelope Cruz character, that's the kind of free spirit.
Yeah, she's...
The Italians are much more pinned down.
Yeah, and Penelope Cruz has these sequences where you're never quite certain if she's tipping over into mental illness or whether she's just a free spirit. You know, she goes in one sequence at a very straight-laced family dinner, a Christmas dinner, she climbs under the table with the kids.
To be
with the children, and she's crawling around on the floor. Well, this is actually more than just being a free spirit. This is actually quite disturbing behaviour. Right. And she does end up, I mean, I don't want to spend, but I mean, it does turn out that she really is tipping over.
I'm interested that the Italians, we wouldn't necessarily, as Irish people, think of them as...
It's more this family at that time, isn't it?
Yeah, it is that kind of bourgeois Italian family.
Okay.
Yeah.
Stars from you on this one, Ruth?
I gave it 3. I thought, you know, it was great. It was good, but it wasn't great.
Good, but not great.
And total agreement. I gave it 3 as well. And actually, even though Penelope Cruz isn't right for it, she's really good at it.
Oh, she's fantastic. I mean, you'd look at her in anything,
I don't know what the equivalent of Read the Telephone Book is in film terms, but she can do whatever that is.
Whatever she wants.
She's just the camera. Yeah. The camera loves her, I guess.
She's ageless as well.
All right, let us move finally then to Disney and a film called Haunted Mansion. Second go at making a film inspired by a theme park ride, Haunted Mansion. Ruth, you've seen this one briefly.
One hopes it'll be the last attempt to make this.
I didn't see it, and I like Scooby-Doo. Never mind. Yeah,
I missed the Muppets version too. There's actually 3.
Right, there's 3 versions.
Most recent.
Explain Haunted Mansion, what it is.
Well, it's a very, very famous Disney ride. Yeah. And so this movie is in part aimed for those who have kind of nostalgic feelings about the ride. And then they've fashioned this story out of the ride. So really, really briefly, Ben is a prominent astrophysicist. He's played actually very well, as much as he can do anything with the story, by Lakeith Stanfield. He's a prominent astrophysicist. It's set in New Orleans. On a night out, he meets this tour guide, Alyssa, played by Charity Gordon. He falls for her. Cut to a few years later, he's lost her. She died in a car accident. I'm not telling you anything that doesn't happen very, very quickly. And then he is introduced to this single mom, Gabby, who has... for some extraordinary reason, bought a haunted mansion. And so when she realises she's living amongst ghosts, she calls in Father Kent, played remarkably badly by Owen Wilson, who's really
saying
there.
It really well, Ruth.
I love it. Loved this movie. Loved it. And then he contacts Ben, because Ben has this particular equipment that can photograph ghosts. As you would if you're an astrophysicist.
Of course you would. Astrophysicists have those in their laboratories all the time. Tiffany Haddish plays the part of Harriet, who is
She's the medium who's called in to exercise.
She's explaining to everybody here the difficult task that she has at hand in terms of dealing with this haunted mansion fair ride, is that what you call them? The voices of Rosario Dawson and Owen Wilson are also in this scene.
And let me tell you, it will fight back. Ghosts like to fight. For example, 1813, a group of mediums went into the house just a little north of here. It took 21 days. They worked their butts off and they got that deceased owner out of there. But they were all found. How old are you?
9.
Okay, I'm talking organs on the outside.
Oh, 9 is young.
It's not that young, girl. I was driving by 9. Look, I know that might have been an extreme example.
Yes.
But they were a group of amateurs. I am a professional, okay? I'm bona fide and qualified, certified, and I can get rid of what died.
A lot of equal opportunity casting as well.
Yeah, but just have to say, when I heard that, this is the third time I heard that clip, and I thought, surely this is a comedy.
But it doesn't know what it is, because I think, you know, it does sort of play off these different characters that we're supposed to be familiar with.
Great cast as well.
Great cast. I mean, and they also have Jamie Lee Curtis, who's now a national treasure and actually turns up in anything. Mm-hmm.
Danny DeVito,
who actually really, really is almost as bad as Owen Wilson in just sort of taking the check and doing the walk-on part. He only ever does Danny DeVito at this stage. So yeah, great actors, and you put them in motion, but they're just as flat as, you know, a squashed ghost.
Who's to blame?
I suspect, well, the people whose original idea it was to capitalise on what was great for Pirates of the Caribbean and is just not working for Haunted Mansion. Disney is desperate for money. They are, you know, if you read your headlines, they are now really short. They've had crash after crash after crash. I think they thought, we'll make this really middle-of-the-road movie and it'll get everybody in because it's a kids' movie. Why it's coming out in summer when I would have thought this was a Halloween movie, but anyway, let's not worry about time too much. I think they just got it out there to get the dollars in.
And Jay, it was directed by Justin Simien, but Guillermo del Toro's name was originally attached, wasn't it?
They initially wanted Guillermo del Toro to do it, and if he'd made this, now that would have been interesting.
Might have been a different movie.
Yeah, this is just very, very bland. It's really by numbers.
Is there anything in it to recommend it?
Well, the cast, the cast.
Even though you're saying both Owen Wilson and Danny DeVito are pretty
awful.
But
Charity Gordon's good, Rosario Dawson's good, Tiffany Haddish is excellent. Jamie Lee Curtis is just kind of having a bit of fun, which seems to be what she's doing at the moment, and good for
her. She's good at that.
She's great, love it.
All right, is it getting any stars from you, Ruth?
Well, I gave it two, and I'm not quite sure why I didn't give it one, but I think I was just feeling fantastically generous and the spirit entered me, and then I gave it two.
All right, you gave it two. You booking your tickets immediately for that one, Paul?
Straight away.
Yeah. I can see Paul shedding tears. Why did I not see this movie?
That's Ruth Barton and Paul Whittington there. Gran Turismo, Facedown, La Mensita and Haunted Mansion, all released in cinemas this week. Now, set in West Cork, The Well of St. Nobody is the 10th book from writer and filmmaker Neil Jordan. English concert pianist William Barrow has been forced to retire due to ill health, begins a new life. On advertising for a housekeeper, he meets Tara, middle-aged piano teacher looking for extra work and who, it turns out, is a figure from his past. Nothing is ever straightforward in a Neil Jordan tale, whether it's on the page or on the screen. Peter Murphy has been reading The Well of St. Nobody for us, and he's with me in studio now. And we were saying just before we started, we were speaking during the nook, Peter, it's easy to forget the writing output, as in novels, pages, books, stories of Neil Jordan. It's easy for that to get lost in the midst of his filmmaking.
Yeah, and he was like established as a serious writer way back in the early 70s. So he established the Irish Writers Co-op in 1974, which was a fairly serious kind of way station for emerging Irish writers. I read an interview with him recently where he was saying the only problem with it that it was so successful that writers would pass through it and then go get a major deal, a major literary deal with major publishing houses and never do anything again. But Night in Tunisia came out in the early 70s, won the Guardian First Book Award and the Somerset Maugham Award, and he won the Rooney Prize. And then there was... what else was there? There was like Sunrise with Sea Monster, the novellas, and then there's like eight novels, I think, concurrently with his film career. But he was always a really literate filmmaker anyway. So,
well, it's the original studies, I think. His original studies were English
and history at UCD.
Yeah.
Born in Sligo, but pretty much brought up in Dublin.
Yeah. that literary bent was there. And as you say, that literary bent is there in the films as well, if you don't have to look too hard for it.
Yeah, I understand why, writing is probably the last auteur pursuit left in the culture industries, where you don't have to deal with the money men. And I can quite understand the joy and the sense of control that he would get through writing. And it actually comes through in every line in this book, as a sense of sort of gentle immersion and absorption into the joy of writing sentences. He's a really beautiful writer, as in a very controlled and disciplined writer. If you look at the films that he's adapted, early on in The Company of Wolves was fantastic, but he worked with Angela Carter on that. I interviewed him once, maybe 12 years ago. I was fascinated as to what it was like to work with her. And then Graham Greene, The End of the Affair.
Yeah.
He adapted and The Butcher Boy, of course, and interviewed the vampire, Anne Rice. So this is like
Breakfast at Pluto as well, all of those.
And to get to the point of The Well of St. Nobody is like the area that he deals with is somewhere between, it's the neo-realist end of Gothic. It would be like low-dose gothic.
Low-dose gothic. And you do like a bit of goth, I'm sure. So maybe your low-dose goth might be a bit further up the dosage.
Oh, I got hardcore goth. Yeah.
So listen, let's get the... I think it was two films, he said, that inspired the writing, or certainly fed into the writing of this book, The Well of St. Nobody.
I'm quite amazed. There's an author's note at the back basically fessing up to having lifted the basic plots. Letter from an Unknown Woman.
I think adapting the basic plots is possibly that he didn't have. Did he? Or maybe he did use the term lifted.
Well, there is that famous thing of like the Greeks say there's only seven stories.
Yeah.
And he's lifted two of them. But it's Letter from an Unknown Woman by Max Ophuls. He says he saw it 40 years ago. And which was... and then there's Lost Sex by Kenito Shindo. One of them about a pianist who meets a female fan at various points throughout his life, which is the central riff of this book. And another one about a cleaning lady who invents a legend in order to establish a relationship with a kabuki actor, which is the other main strain of this book. People get all head up about the idea of originality. It's execution is all, I think, and they're really good stories. The third factor that plays into this is during the pandemic, he was struck with arthritic psoriasis of the hands, and he couldn't so much as scramble an egg. The only thing he could do was write. Hence this book, and this book is set kind of at the tail end of COVID. So the central conceit that you have to buy if you're going to buy the story of this novel is this. It's quite an interesting one, and it plays into the Gothic idea of the double and memory in the past. The character of Tara has met William Barrow when he was a successful concert pianist. She met him as a student partaking in a competition. Then she met him as a fan backstage after a concert. And then she met him as a lover, one night stand. So she meets him again in West Cork. She recognizes his shambling shape. He is sort of like, he's like a human version of those once elegant old seaside towns. He's kind of like a 6'2" version of Brighton. sort of elegant in a way. A relic of old decency is the phrase that comes up. But in that way, and we've all seen this kind of character, he also wears like anoraks and trainers that a teenager would turn their nose up at, which is...
It's most anoraks and most trainers, I suppose. certainly that an older man would be wearing.
So he doesn't... Initially, she's wearing a COVID mask. So we can kind of understand why he mightn't recognize her. But even when the mask is removed, he doesn't remember her. And it's a major kind of source of tension in the story.
There are a couple of elements that run through it. I wonder to what role does the piano playing play, if you like? Because he's a concert pianist who's now retired. She is a piano teacher, but kind of is barely making the ends meet.
Yeah. Playing Dr. Freud, I wonder, is there a parallel to be drawn between a concert pianist who, from forces outside of himself can no longer play, and a filmmaker who can no longer make films because of the hostile nature of the culture in terms of grown-up adult films, the kind of which Neil Jordan specialises in. Mr. Jordan is doing rather better than William Barrow, but there's a sense of him sort of in decay. He's lonely, but he's getting by, but there's no lust for life in him until he meets this woman.
This Tara. We don't ever learn Tara's second name.
Do we? May Crow, is it Max something? I can't quite remember now.
It may or may not be there. The title of the book, however, The Well of Saint Nobody, brings us into another kind of, I'm using the term supernatural, I don't know if that's quite the right term to use, but there's certainly another worldliness to this well, and that's part of the story you were telling about the film, that the woman who makes up a tale just to get have a love affair with a kabuki actor. This is something similar, a potential well that they discover.
Yeah, early on in the, it's crucial to the plot and crucial to the themes of it, but early on in the story, he almost falls into this overgrown well. He doesn't realise it's there. Manages to haul himself back out, and he goes into her on her first or second day on the job, and she helps pull the thorns from his fingers, and she begins to make up a yarn about the well. She begins to tell him, spin him a total spoofer's legend, as they do in West Cork and indeed in every other part of the country. and she makes up this saint and this riff about, well, having healing properties. But there's quite an interesting subtext in there about the power of belief.
Does it actually have that power because you believe it has that power?
Yes. What do you call it? Is it a placebo or whatever?
Placebo effect, I suppose.
So his hands, she takes the moss from the well and massages his hands with it, and his psoriasis begins to clear up.
Yeah, now, so is it magic? That kind of magical realism is not unusual in Jordan's writing and indeed his filmmaking. Touch of the magical realism.
Yeah, I mean, his entire career can be kind of summed up by virtue of how many clicks there are on the Gothic Geiger counter, whereas there have been like 9 in Interview with a Vampire and there have been maybe 3 in Ondine. And the novels tend to lean on a sort of residual atmosphere. They're kind of gothy around the edges. They're vaguely foggy.
Foggy at the edges. How important is the West Cork setting? Does it feature a lot in the book?
Place is important in all Neil Jordan's work, whether it's, you know, old Gothic Dublin or... Yeah, it's just a sense of being slightly removed from the world. It's a very small cast of characters. Quite wisely, he's kept it down to about 5 or 6 people.
Yeah, and it's essentially that couple, and there's another character called Huey, isn't there?
Who is kind of the change agent. He arrives about 2/3 of the way in, and I'll say nothing more plot-wise after that.
Fair enough.
Because I don't want to ruin it. Although I will say this, it's a real trick to wrap up a novel well, to end a novel well, or to do the third act of a novel well. And Neil Jordan does it exquisitely well here. I was like bravoing on the train as I was reading the last 40 pages. It had a really satisfying wallop. Wallop is the wrong word, like a slow landing, a glide into the airport.
This sounds as if you had a good time reading this
book,
Peter.
I really did, yeah. It's, you know, it's not... It's neither Airport Novel nor William Faulkner. Mm. It's that really lovely sweet spot. It reminded me a lot of Patrick McGrath's novels, another practitioner of the Gothic. A wonder that Neil Jordan's never adapted a Patrick McGrath novel.
For the screen.
I don't think. Yeah. Cronenberg did Spider and somebody did Asylum. Just that, that sense of really well-observed character, and I tell you what's really... virtuoso here is the way that he moves between free and direct speech for 3 principal characters really kind of seamlessly from their point of view. There's 3 alternating points of view necessitating 3 very subtle changes in register and pitch and it's done very elegantly.
I don't think I need to ask, are you recommending this book?
I would, yep.
Yeah,
absolutely.
sounds as if you are.
No, there's nothing, you know, no rocket science here. It's a good book.
It's a good book. That's Peter Murphy speaking to us there about The Well of St. Nobody by Neil Jordan, which is published by Head of Zeus. OxyContin was the drug that was going to cure the world of pain, but as we all know, it went on to spark the opioid addiction epidemic, killing thousands in the process. The story of OxyContin, its creators Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family who own the company, is an intriguing real-life horror tale. But how many TV series can this story feed? Dopesick? Well, actually, we're going to talk about the one that's starting on Painkiller, and while we're talking about that with Jen Gannon, we can go through kind of what we've had. We have had this story, and I'm not dismissing the importance of the story. Mm. It's a hugely important story, and it is a story that needed to be told. But did we need another telling of it right now? Is
so
my question.
Soon, I think. Yeah. Like, I mean, I
the
know
the big one was Dopesick. Let's talk about it. The Michael Keaton one, which was hugely successful.
Hugely,
I think.
And I think, you know, they benefited from getting in quickly, as quickly as they could. Now, Dopesick was 2 years ago, would you believe? Which it didn't feel like that.
And last week, yeah, thing, it's, that feel off it.
That's it. With Painkiller, this new drama from Netflix, you do feel it like it's a deep impact Armageddon kind of situation where you have, you know, the two competing dramas. And really with Dopesick, you know, it was like Michael Keaton's performance did earn him a Golden Globe, and also just kind of reignited this feeling around him as a great actor. But then you also had a really, for me, a stirring performance from Michael Stuhlbarg in it as well as Richard Sackler. And it, I think it's very fresh in people's minds. And it was so garlanded with praise when it did come out. That
and the other great thing about the Michael Keaton character was he was a doctor who was, you know,
turned pusher almost, and then turned addict.
Yeah. So you got the full cycle. You saw how when this drug took hold of people, it just pulled them right down.
Yeah.
And to the extent where he was this lovely family doctor who was suddenly then peddling the drug, as you say, almost, and then was a victim.
And then under its spell,
an addict himself. So it was a very strong story. This is a different, it has a different focus in many ways.
I mean, I think the issue for a lot of people with Dopesick was it had too many strands.
There was a lot going on.
From the FDA to the FBI, you had this kind of timeline moving from 1996 to, you know, into the 2000s, and it flipped all over the place.
Yeah.
Whereas this is, I think it learned from the mistakes that Dopesick maybe made, because it is a lot streamlined, and it follows, Uzo Aduba, who you know from Orange is the New Black, and she plays Edie Flowers, and she's a lawyer working for the US Attorney's Office, and she's been investigating on the trail of the destructive path of OxyContin for years, and she's headed to Washington because finally, after years and years of struggle, Richard Sackler is being deposed, and then the story kind of moves backwards from that into her past, into how she learned about the drug, and then the characters she's kind of encountered along the way. And there are, you know, a few main standout characters then that they follow. So it's not as complicated. There's not as many layers to it.
It's essentially, we see her in today, if you like, at the present moment being when they're going to get Sackler. They're going to follow him and they're going to bring him down. And she doesn't believe that's going to happen. But then it goes right back to her beginnings as an investigative, I don't know what you would call her. She worked for the Department, I'm saying the Department of Health, but the equivalent is in the US. She worked for them, and she went around kind of finding doctors, chemists, pharmacists who were up to dodgy activity.
Exactly.
We're going to get a sense of what she was like in those early days. She visits a Dr. Coyle, and she has a few suspicions about him. And here's her first visit to him.
I need to speak to Dr. Coyle, please.
And you are?
Edie Flowers. So I asked you if there was anything else I needed to know, and you said no. Great?
Yeah, right.
You're not being honest with me, Dr. Coyle.
I told you everything.
You prescribed a new drug, one I have never even heard of. 1,098 times in 6 months. That's more prescriptions than there are patients, and nearly 5% of Carroll County. But what we both know is that those patients don't exist, and that you are running some dumb, idiotic, little stupid jackass scheme. Now, I gave you a chance. And now it's gonna hurt.
Okay, just wait a second, okay?
Dr. Coyle, what can you tell me about OxyContin?
And that's actually a little, that's Edie Flowers played by Uzo Aduba and Dr. Coyle. They're under pressure, clearly. That's early on in the, reasonably early on in the first episode. Jen Gannon has been watching Painkiller, the new Netflix six-episode series telling the story of OxyContin and the and Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family. That's quite early enough into episode one, which does go right back to just the beginnings of those, the scrapings around people who were discovering, why are so many people being prescribed this drug?
And why, you know, why can't they keep a handle on it? As it seems to be, you know, everywhere. But she was really kind of informing people about it more. Like, she was there from the jump, as in a lot of the people that she comes into contact with, her higher-uppers basically aren't aware of the actual impact.
She started investigating that Dr. Coyle over a dodgy X-ray machine he had made. You know, and but then she kind of, once she opened up the books, she starts to see everything.
And she starts to see all the connections that are made then about, you know, how it all comes from this stuffed toy. There's a stuffed toy of a you know, OxyContin little round tablet with eyes basically on these doctor's desks. And it's like that relationship between the sales reps and advertising, and how, you know, it's insidious, and how it gets, you know, that really kind of greedy relationship between big pharma and the doctors getting it into the surgeries and pushing it in that way and pushing it onto patients. And it is kind of neatly tied up where you're looking at this soft toy and thinking, you know, it's a real McDonald's Happy Meal kind of moment. And that's the, you know, the illusion there, like the kind of reference there is like it's one in every home. That's the way they wanted it. The Sackler family, that's the way that they wanted it to be seen.
The Sackler family, I suppose we look at the Sackler family through two characters. They keep referring back to Arthur Sackler, who was the guy at the beginning of this family, the beginning of the whole Purdue Pharma, setting up all the companies. And his, he was the Valium was his big drug. He was the breakthrough there.
He was. And it was like to sell it to the housewives, to make it as, you know, almost the mother's helper in a way.
The drug you never knew you needed.
Exactly. And then,
so they had these slogans. That was the Sackler family way of working really, from early on.
That relationship between advertising and drugs, like to make it seem like it's something homely and, you know, a nice kind of homespun thing rather than something that is, could affect your life in a detrimental way. And they also show, you know, the Sackler family involved in lobotomies. And just a word of warning for the very, if you're squeamish, they are not shying away in this show of showing really graphic sides of operations.
Even people who get injured and have to go on OxyContin, then they show you the really...
And they even show autopsies and everything like that. So if you are, you know, err on the side of caution for those moments, because they really get into the nitty gritty of it. But I mean, I think the introduction of that, the Sackler family is, they're essentially unknowable in a way. They live on this, you know, Mount Olympus where they use their money. But it's also like Richard Sackler, who's played by Matthew Broderick, Ferris Bueller himself. He is trying to get the company back on track. He feels he's almost like, in a way, the Kendall Roy in trying to, wanting to prove himself to his dead father and wanting to prove the family name and bring it back. And he, the way he does that is through this wonder drug, this OxyContin.
And here is part of the way he begins. He really sees this relationship between marketing and pharmacy. And big pharma. That's where his strengths lie, which is kind of like, Arthur Sackler was his uncle, wasn't he? So here is Matthew Broderick as Richard Sackler explaining how to sell the idea of pain and pleasure. That's what he's doing here. A little bit of language just towards the end of this clip, be warned.
We know pain.
Yeah, that's for damn sure.
We developed MS Cotton. We understand pain. I understand pain. All of human behavior is essentially comprised of two things, running away from pain and toward pleasure. It's a cycle. Run from pain, run toward pleasure. Pain, pleasure, again and again. Well, this circle is our existence. It is the very essence of what it means to be human, to be alive. But if we place ourselves right there between pain and pleasure, if we become the gatekeepers for everyone who wants to get away from pain, then we have changed the world. We finish what Arthur started. And You will never have to worry about money ever again. Fuck yeah.
There you go, Matthew Broderick as Richard Sackler there in a scene from the new Netflix series Painkiller. Jen Gannon watching it for us. I was saying as we were listening to that clip, there is another kind of strand to the story they're telling. So actually, before I go to that one, I want to say the way they start each episode is hugely important and hugely affecting.
It's it begins with a real life person talking into the lens about their own family members who have been absolutely destroyed by addiction or even experimentation with the drug itself. And you can take that two ways. You can either feel like it is because they're saying, look, this is a true story. This is happening on your doorstep. This is not a drama. This is reality. And it is all based on these stories, these people's stories. It's an amalgamation of all those stories. It's, you know, based on a New Yorker article. And I think you can either find that very effective or you can find it a little bit after school special and a little bit preachy. But I think what they want to do is hammer home that it's a reality. And they're even like they have as an executive producer Alex Gibney is serving as an executive producer. He was the documentarian who did The Crime of the Century about opioid addiction. So they really want to make sure that people understand that it's not fantasy. This is reality.
Yeah, and it's very effective because for me, I thought it was effective because you get this ordinary person, this real person saying the story that you're told here is based on real events and with fictionalized names, etc., etc. But this story is true, and they talk either about their son,
this is about my
their
son,
daughter,
or,
their sister, whatever it is. And maybe it was just the first episode.
It's very moving because it is. Yeah. It shocks you into something that you're not expecting, I think.
Now, the other strand that I wanted to touch on just before we finish up is we do get into the sales room and the people who are employed as salespeople, and in particular one young girl who's very sexualized in the way that, in the story that they tell. And I wondered where that was going. Maybe explain who she is and does it develop that through the series?
Wasn't delighted with that. There's these two blonde OxyContin kind of cheerleaders, pharmaceutical sales reps. One is older, she's a kind of shark-eyed senior, and then she's training the newcomer called Shannon, who's played by David Duchovny's daughter, Wes Duchovny, and she's barely out of school and she's eager to learn, you know, the tricks of the trade. Yeah. She wants to get ahead and earn serious money, and it's all a bit Wolf of Wall Street in that way, like about like how they drum up this attention, and that's all good, but I do think both of the young women, they're outlined as these kind of hyper sorority girls with this kind of vacant kind of twist. And it is trying to show, I suppose, the girl bossification of white feminism and how, you know, independence is used as its buzzword to kind of paper over the cracks of, you know, capitalism, late stage capitalism and greed. But I do think they're depicted as these kind of mannequins of the American dream, and it's a bit cliche. I thought Dobesick did that much better with Will Poulter's character.
His character was brilliant.
Who made friends with, you know, Dr. Phoenix and Fenix, and how their relationship kind of evolved.
All right. I don't know how much of the six episodes you've seen, and in 10 seconds, are you recommending it or not?
I would say, you know, look, Dobesick is one thing. I'd say, look, if you want something that's a little bit more streamlined, it's Peter Berg who directed it. He directed Friday Night Lights. You know what you're getting. It's kind of more homespun. It's more like a drama than the intensity of Dobesick. So I think if you want something more simpler to digest, maybe, then Painkiller is the one.
Painkiller is the one. Okay. And it starts on Netflix on August the 10th. I think all six episodes.
All six episodes today.
That is today. Right, as I look down at my page, today is Thursday, August 10th. So it's available on Netflix from today. And that is our lot for this Thursday evening, August the 10th. Paula Shields was the researcher this evening. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Harry Brooklis was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Ola McGowan. Talk to you tomorrow night once again, 6:30 here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon is on the way.